saying about visiting congressional members and going on the Hill. We just came back 2 weeks ago from our National Advocacy Weekend, where we brought 36 activists from all over the country who are of Latino descent, and half of them didn't speak English. So we're like, wow, how are we going to organize these congressional meetings? We had sort of translators join these meetings, but we told these immigrant women, you talk to the staffer, you look them in the eye, you look at the eye of the legislator, you talk to them. You don't talk through the translator to talk to them. I want you to talk to them, even if they don't understand a word that you're saying, because we want them to know that this is coming from your heart and this is coming from your experience. So it was really empowering for them, and they were so sort of impressed by the grandeur of D.C., but we have to reinforce that these people represent you and that they need to hear your voices. So I definitely appreciate your advice, and we hope to move forward as well and bring those voices forward. So I'm going to try to be really quick, actually, and I might skip some slides just for allow for some time for conversation and questions. Just real briefly, I'm going to talk a little bit about reproductive justice. I'm going to offer the perspective of Latinas, and particularly immigrant women. I'm going to just maybe address very quickly some of the barriers that exist to reproductive health care for Latinas. It's shown the uninsurance rate, and this is important just because of the context of universal health care. We need to understand who is not being served at the moment. Some of the disparities that exist, and how do we advocate for health care for all. The important framework that a lot of organizations use in advancing the reproductive health and rights of communities is the term reproductive justice and the framework of reproductive justice, which basically includes everyone regardless of race, age, ability, national origin, income, sexual orientation, or gender expression, have equal rights and access to reproductive health services, as well as the right to make informed decisions about whether or when to have children, and then additionally how to raise the children that you have. So we really utilize this framework in advancing any of the reproductive justice issues that come forth, and we look at the intersectionality that exists, because you can't take your race out of you. You can't take your immigration status out of you. You can't separate these silos and only address your right to reproductive health care as your identity as a woman, but you have to also look at your identity as an immigrant, as a poor person, as someone who is LGBT, etc. So we really want to address and reinforce the intersectionality and the intersectional nature of all these identities that impact on women's lives. Just a bit about Latina Institute. We hope to advance reproductive justice through policy advocacy, public education, and community mobilization. And we're very excited to be part of the Raising Women's Voices campaign, and we'll also be organizing some focus groups and some conversations around what are the needs of the immigrant and Latina communities. We're going to be going to Texas actually later in the month and start having some conversations with women on the U.S.-Mexico border, so we're really excited about that. So very briefly, and anyone who came to my cervical cancer presentation, some of the slides overlap, but basically we're a large population, Latinas. We're a new population. We're young. We're not new, but we're very recent as far as some of the immigrants. A lot of us have come in the 1990s. Many of us have been here for generations, and many of us are indigenous, so we've been here for a very long time. And Latinas particularly are about 12% of the women population of women in the U.S., and we're over 17 million. Just interesting to note, undocumented versus documented immigrants in the United States. Undocumented immigrants are largely male, and that sometimes is due to some of the jobs that they come to this country for. But it's important to note that even though a majority are male, 42% are women, and 42% of women are doing work in migrant seasonal farm worker work. They're doing household domestic work. And restaurant and other industries as well. So it's really important to understand that the conversation around immigration has only looked at men, and we really need to insert the gender perspective in this dialogue. Those who have come by legal means are largely women. What are the barriers? We have lack of health insurance, and I'll address that later. Any immigration policies that we're facing? Anyone who's kept up on the news knows that this is a xenophobic time, that we're really faced with hate and racism and xenophobia, and it's just a really awful time, but we really need to continue to work and to continue to fight for the rights of immigrants. We have cultural language barriers, unequal treatment, lack of health information, and all these things lead to health disparities that exist in our communities. And I want to acknowledge, all of you I'm sure know, but you know, while Latinos tend to be dominate the conversation around immigration, it's important to acknowledge that there's immigrants that come from all countries, and that you know that we work in coalition with Asian Pacific American women's organizations, Arab women's organization, African women's organization, as well as Indigenous women's organizations. So it's important to understand, as much as Congress doesn't really address that, that there's other immigrants outside of the Latino population. So quickly, we have the highest uninsured rate among all racial and ethnic groups. Amongst low-income Latina of reproductive age, like 15 to 44, almost 60% of us are uninsured. And because of some of the migratory work that we do, we sometimes have insurance for half of the year or part of the year, not all of the year. So, and transportation, particularly in rural communities, is a tremendous barrier to health care. This is from 2001, so the data is not completely correct, but you can see the disparities in the first line in each section: uninsured, no regular provider, and reporting in fair or poor health circumstances is very high amongst women of color. Immigration, there's a lot of immigration policies, and that's why, again, we have to look at intersectionality. Immigration policies prevent immigrant women who have legal status to access publicly funded health care for the first 5 years. So this means that, and children, I want to reinforce that, because SCHIP is up for debate, and our children are being, again, disenfranchised and marginalized from this conversation. Language proficiency is also an issue. There's a direct correlation between immigration status, language proficiency, and rate of insurance. And you can see those who are English speaking are a little more likely to be insured than those who are non-Spanish speaking. Although, of course, they're not quite, they don't have high rates of insurance, but it's a little bit more based on their language proficiency. So just really quick, you know, all these public programs basically lock us out of accessing certain services, and because of that, these health disparities emerge. 33% of Latinas did not receive a pap smear, therefore we're more likely to get cervical cancer and to catch it at a later stage. We have some of the highest rates of cervical cancer. Many of us are having abortions, but the Hyde Amendment prohibits access to federally funded abortions. So unfortunately, where we are in New York State, they're more liberal. They allow for federal funds, state funds to be used for abortion. But in other states, women turn to very desperate means and use drugs like misoprostol, which I'm not sure people are aware of, but it's an ulcer medication that some women use to induce self-induce abortions. So it actually been two cases where women have been arrested and charged for these bizarre draconian laws that criminalize them for seeking self-inducing abortions. So what does this lead to? High teen pregnancy, high unintended pregnancy, high breast and cervical cancer rate, high STIs, the gamut. So these are issues that are important to the Latino community, and you're seeing we're not having tremendous access to these services. So that leads us to why universal health care needs to be reinforced and addressed as a human right. And we went back and looked at some of the human rights conventions and agreements that that we're part of, and understanding that there's a history and a sense of in these conventions that we are part, that universal health care is a human right. So the U.S. Human Rights Network Health Caucus, they have some really good guidelines and some standards for looking at healthcare policies. So recognizing the right to care, ensuring that it's equitable, ensuring that it protects from discrimination, that it's accessible to everyone, and that's why, again, I'm talking about immigrant women, because they're always excluded from that everyone, that it's affordable, that ensures acceptable quality of services, that includes some accountability from the private sector, and that it has a process for evaluation, monitoring, and public transportation. I just want to mention some of the international laws that support this concept. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 25, the International Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, a few articles there, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, and the Convention of the Rights of the Child. So this is really inherent and inclusive in many of these international treaties and laws. So as advocates, I think we kind of talked a lot about this, but what are some of the challenges and opportunities? And one of the biggest challenges is the political environment, and we have a polarized Congress, and where Democrats are in a slight majority, I don't think we're seeing that really impact some of the health work, that's the health policy that's been coming out of the Congress. We're sort of at a deadlock at some proposals. We're seeing a Congress that's anti-woman, anti-choice, homophobic, anti-immigrant, and we're finding an example like with the state children's health insurance program bill that they, in compromise, they removed IKEA, which is the Immigrant Children's Health Improvement Act, and they removed that from one of the earlier versions of SCHIP, and this was sort of a compromising chip, basically, that, you know, well, we'll take these immigrant children out, and then maybe we can pass it. No, that's not okay. You know, these children need coverage. And again, this is legal. This is legal, those who have status, and they're trying to take them out and using them as, like, a bargaining tool. And the elections show that there's quite a polarizing debate. You're hearing the word socialized medicine. You're hearing all sorts of language. You're seeing the influence on the religious right and the conservative right on this debate. But, again, elections bring us some opportunities. As some folks mentioned, there's a number of healthcare plans presented by candidates. We need to address them. We need to examine them. We need to question them and ensure that this is inclusive of all people. And there's great attention. I think the movie Sicko really came out at a timely moment in society that we're looking at this 45 million uninsured people in the United States, and people are talking about it. There's been some really, really great articles highlighting the plight of the uninsured and that they're working people. And also the will. I think that a lot of this exposure has people, you know, talking about it, raising questions, really saying, yes, this is a system that we need and it needs to address all our healthcare issues and concerns. So just some advice for those who are going to move forward and walk out of here and work in coalition and do some amazing things. We hope to be principled. We need to be principled. We need to ensure inclusion of immigrants. We need to embrace a human rights framework that embraces the concept of reproductive justice that's, again, intersectional. We need to ensure linguistically and culturally appropriate care. We need to ensure comprehensive care. And again, you know, someone said that, oh, reproductive health care, I think you said it, right? So, you know, what does that mean? That, you know, we have to say abortion, we have to spell it out, and that this is not a negotiating chip as well, and that ensure that it's affordable. And that's it for me, and I want to acknowledge some of the really great references that provide lots of great data on the work, and particularly the Having Our Say Coalition. Actually, Lois and I were both on a call about California, and California has some really interesting proposals, and there's a senator, I can't pronounce her name, but it's
Keel,
yeah. She has a proposal that really includes people despite documentation, and I think it's one of the most comprehensive proposals, and I would like to see those kind of proposals being move forward in this debate. So they have a really good website as well as the wonderful resources that all these organizations provide. Thank you.
Thank you.
Obviously, we've given you a lot of information, and I'm sorry we have just a short period of time for questions, but let's go at it. Who's got questions, comments, suggestions? Lourdes.
Lourdes, in your slides, you had reference to euthanasia. Can you talk a little bit about why we should care about that?
Okay.
you know, what's significant about that?
Yeah.
Religious voices that are women.
on the progressive religious groups. The reason why we should pay attention to the pairing of abortion and euthanasia in those key criteria from the National Right to Life group and some of the other ones is the way they define euthanasia. They don't define it as, I'm going to kill you. They define it to include the kind of situation we saw in the Terri Schiavo case, where you have people who, you know, either are in a permanent vegetative state or suffering tremendously and would like to be able to have their advance directives followed or their wishes honored to have a peaceful death with dignity. The potential may be that providers would be penalized for that kind of thing or not be allowed to withdraw a feeding tube from someone in a terrible state. And so I think actually we need to partner, we in the reproductive health community, with some of the groups that are working so hard, like hospice and some of the end-of-life care groups that are working to have compassionate care for people at the end of life.
Bill?
Yeah.
Quickly, one point to that, why it's particularly important for women is that, as we mentioned earlier, women do so much of the caretaking and we tend to live longer than our spouses. And so we face those decisions not just in our own lives, but as healthcare decision makers for our family members.
That's great. And in terms of the progressive religious groups, it's a wonderful suggestion. Obviously, we've seen in the reproductive health movement having clergy for choice, people of faith for choice has just been so important. The fact that we have had Reverend Carlton Beasy as the head of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice has made a tremendous difference in, you know, making sure that we have faith on our side too, that what we're talking about is a moral choice here, that providing health care for people is moral. That's a moral value, and we care, and we have ethics, too.
Did you want to add
something? I just want to mention that United Methodist Church is very involved, and also we just had a conversation with the Religious Coalition for Abortion Rights, who want to join our advisory board, and we had a meeting of our conference planning committee, and one of the suggestions was that we should have a whole panel on talking about what religious groups can do to be involved. So we got that on our radar.
Good. Susan Wood?
Did not specify abortion because private plans did cover this.
valuable lesson for us to keep in mind as we go forward. Back there.
We're trying to get the thing moved. We're trying to move.